August Paul Chisjach. This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records. Since 2014, I have been hosting this radio hour and am honoured to have the opportunity to bring to you interviews, talks and performances which speak to the Irish and Irish-American experience. As a historian trained in Ireland, Italy and the US, I have used interviews as a major component of my research, and I am always thrilled and honoured to use the medium of radio to share aspects of educational and ethnic interest. WNYE 91.5 FM is managed and operated by NYC Media, a part of the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. Broadcasting throughout the metropolitan area from the 4 Times Square Tower in Midtown Manhattan, it serves the public 24/7 with its schedule of programming. The programming aims to inform, educate, and reflect the diversity of interests that make up New York City's population. I hope you'll enjoy this week's This Irish American Life. I'd like to open this week's This Irish American Life by paying tribute to our colleague and mentor and influencer, Professor Mick Maloney, who passed away unexpectedly and suddenly in recent weeks. It is often said that, you know, there is a big gap left behind someone and they've had an immense impact. And I feel like that's an understatement when you apply it to Mick. He was a larger-than-life figure. He was a really talented multi-instrumentalist. But beyond his talent with musical instruments, his intellect and his capacity as an innovator and change maker and change agent was immense. It is no exaggeration to say that Irish New York, Irish America, the Irish diaspora is really reeling and trying to comprehend how we navigate a new world order without Mick in it, because his tentacles, his projects impacted on so many lives. And when you think back on all that Mick did, it had that impact that was down into pubs and halls and was right up to the highest echelons of academia. Since his untimely passing in recent weeks, the tributes have flowed in, and it has been really, really encouraging to see just how well regarded he was in so many circles right across the United States and the diaspora and beyond. He was a figure who was truly towering in his presence and his impact, and his capacity to collaborate and to forge linkages with others, with other musicians, with other academics, with other practitioners, was just something to behold. I said to someone after he died that in a way I feel like we always just expected Mick to be there, and because he was so influential in terms of his reach that we could never imagine what it would be like to not have him working in Irish studies and doing all the work that he did. But now we have to contemplate that reality, and I will in the very near future put together a proper tribute to Mick. He was a regular contributor here to this Irish Radio Hour. He was always generous with his time. He was always very generous in terms of giving us permission to share some of the wonderful music he recorded down through the years with himself and with others. I know that there are so many people who would like to pay tribute to Mick and to his impact on Irish studies and beyond. I've seen some of the feedback of some of, for example, some of the most influential folklorists and ethnomusicologists in the field, responses by people like Professor Tom Rankin at Duke University, Bill Ferris at UNC, Chapel Hill, all these very impactful intellectuals for whom Mick's work in the sphere of Irish music, dance and culture and its influence in American folklore and ethnic studies is just, you know, just essential to the field. He was born in Limerick in Ireland, but he had made the United States his home for many decades, even though he travelled regularly to Ireland and, of course, was immensely connected and immensely held in immense esteem in Irish circles in Ireland. He did unbelievable charity work in Asia in recent years and collaborated with other musicians essentially to give back to others and to extend his own legacy in terms of helping others. He was a very charitable and generous person. Mick was going to the end. He had been involved in the recent Catskills Irish Week, which was, by all accounts, a great reunion after the last few years of COVID interruptions. He had given, he'd been performing in a concert in Maine. He had been performing in New York City. In other words, Mick was being Mick, and there was no sign of what was to come. And when this news broke, it really was stunning, and it's something that we're still digesting. But I suppose if I step back a little bit from the immediate hurt and sadness that we feel as communities, all the communities that he touched, the NYU community, the Irish Arts Centre, the consular community, the Irish music community in terms of the different components of that in New York City and beyond. My goodness, the man had such reach and had such capacity to bring in others and to collaborate. He and I had shared interests. Some of his work has been very influential on me in terms of looking at the comparison of Irish America and Jewish America and Irish America and African American experiences. And I know people like his great friend and collaborator Lenny Sloan are particularly devastated with news of his passing. All this is to say, rest in peace, Mick. We'll come back to pay a fuller tribute to you in this medium in time. And actually, Mick's interests and life's work and celebration is a nice introduction to this week's topic of conversation, a wonderful new publication by a younger generation of Irish history studies scholar who has recovered the voice of a fascinating 19th century Irish immigrant to the United States. I'm looking forward to sharing my chat with Pat Mahoney, Padraig Fia MacMahona with you right now, folks. And I hope you enjoy this week's show. Thanks for tuning in. On this week's This Irish American Life, I am thrilled to welcome to the programme the author of Recovering an Irish Voice from the American Frontier, Patrick J. Mahoney, or Padraig O'Mahoona, as he's known to many. Recovering an Irish Voice from the American Frontier was published by the University of North Texas Press. It sounds actually about a year now, but with the pandemic and everything, it's been probably a little bit slower than normal to get going in terms of lots of conversations, but I'm really thrilled today to welcome Pat to the programme. He is currently a researcher on the Fionn Cycle Folklore Project at Harvard University. He is a former Fulbright Scholar at NUI Galway and earned his PhD in History and Culture at Drew University in the fall of 2021. He is currently working on a monograph entitled The Fenian Empire, Irish Nationalism and American Expansionism, 1866-71, and a currently untitled collection of short stories in Irish.
Cade me lefoil to Pat. It's really great to connect with you, reconnect with you rather today. Thanks for being with us today, agus fáil sé.
For me and Miriam, and thanks for having me. It's great to chat.
I am fascinated by this character who you've uncovered, and I suppose what we should do is from the get-go contextualize Recovering an Irish Voice from the American Frontier centers around a certain gentleman, and his name was Owen O'Cahill. I'm correct there in the on his pronunciation and naming?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you and I have a lot of similarities in terms of our interests, in terms of diaspora and language and identity. And I suppose Owen bundles up in a lot of his biography and his writings a lot of those themes. Can you, for the benefit of our listeners who haven't read the book yet and is really fascinating read, and you've done such a great job in terms of the bilingual translations of his prose. But before we get further into that, can you tell us a little bit, Pat, about Owen O'Cahill and his biography, and I suppose how you came upon working on this, recovering his voice in this way?
Yeah, absolutely. So Owen O'Cahill, I mean, as you say, a fascinating character. He's actually born in Temple Glenton in County Limerick and West Limerick in 1840. And he emigrates over to the U.S. in 1863. And I mean, even I suppose anybody with a passing knowledge of U.S. history, the summer of 1863 is a pretty hot period. You have the Battle of Gettysburg, the Siege of Vicksburg, Chickamauga, and of course the infamous New York City draft riots. And he lands in, and he doesn't actually take the kind of path of a lot of other Irish immigrants and go into the kind of active military service. I suppose he uses a connection that he has with another immigrant who had gone over to the States years before. He uses the connection to get a job in the Quartermaster General's Department. So he actually supplies troops on the front lines and barracks, and he's working at an office in Washington, D.C. So a pretty good place for an Irish immigrant to end up rather than on the bloody battlefields of the time. He's eventually stationed out west, kind of in 1865. He goes out there and he spends a brief period, but that only lasts for about a year. And then he's, you know, totally out of the military, and he moves up to Pentwater, Michigan. And that's where he spends the majority of the rest of his life. He spends a brief time as a Chicago police officer from 1873 to 76. I mean, he lives a pretty, like, fairly regular existence. He operates a pub for over 20 years. He works in the lumber trade, like a lot of other kind of fit young men of the time. He transforms himself into this kind of Western hero, kind of a la Buffalo Bill Cody. Even some of the stories are set in amidst the lumber trade of the upper Midwest. The details of how he depicts his life far outweigh the realities of it. And, you know, one example I'll give is, you know, he talks quite a bit about the Plains Indian Wars. And one of the, he actually writes poetry as well as prose, but this work is only looking at his prose writings. But he says that he was part of the force that was sent out to avenge the death of General Custer. I mean, and this kind of speaks to the recovering of Owen O'Cahill's story as well, because, you know, in my job as a translator and even as a historian in the work, it was as much about translating the works to English and making them readily available to English language readers and scholars and, you know, the general public, as it was about deciphering the fact from fiction in these stories that he's presenting. So one example, he says, okay, I was sent out to avenge the death of General Custer out in the West in 1876. Now, from historical records, we know he was actually patrolling the streets of Chicago as a police officer in 1876. So I knew it wasn't true, but it was kind of deciphering, okay, well, why is he saying this? If you look at it, there was a great marketing campaign, and it's, I mean, funnily enough, one historian has said it's where most people actually learned what they thought that they, you know, their depiction of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, or what they thought the Battle of the Little Bighorn was, comes from a poster that was actually, I suppose, sponsored by Anheuser-Busch. So for anybody not knowing, you know, Budweiser beer out in St. Louis made, they sponsored this kind of lithograph of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, and they sent out free copies to you know, a majority of pubs in the U.S. at the time. Mm-hmm. Now, Onokaho was a pub owner at this time in nearby Michigan. He writes a depiction, and he actually Gaelicizes the event as an Aurkyug Mór in Gaelic for the Little Bighorn. This was his description of it in his little Irish language dictionary, which is in the book, fits quite closely with what's in this depiction of the poster. So he's very imaginative in his description. So that's one example, but I mean, the stories are littered with these kind of, I suppose, nods to American popular culture from the late 19th and early 20th century, where he's using them and he's crafting them, and in a lot of, you know, instances, Gaelicizing them as well for this audience that he hopes to entertain back in Ireland.
Oh, it's so interesting. I have so many questions, Pat, but I want to, before we delve more into, I suppose, aspects of the prose and how you've worked with them in terms of the linguistic elements and, I suppose, thinking about the historical context of what's depicted at times, preparing a little bit for this interview, I read somewhere that something like 94,000 emigrants left Ireland in 1863 for the United States. And I mean, that number should be familiar to me as a historian of migration, but that's a high, high number of people. Like, can you contextualize for us a little bit the wave of migration that Owen would have moved in, or what you know? And, you know, I haven't finished the book yet, so excuse me if this is covered at some point in it. What do we know about the mechanics or modalities of him getting to the United States, Pat, and what was involved, or who he went to, or anything like that? Do you know, were you able to uncover any of that story of his migration?
I know the great Kirby Miller has pinpointed 1863 as, I think, one of the kind of proportionately highest years of emigration since the conclusion of the Great Hunger. And there's a number of reasons for that. I think that Kirby touches on, and rural poverty being one of them, pressure to immigrate actually to bolster the ranks of the U.S. Army, and even the Confederate Army as well had agents in Ireland recruiting people actively, young men, and political pressure as well. In Owen O'Cahill's case, it's kind of interesting because I would have looked at those factors and tried to slot them in. One interesting kind of note is that Owen O'Cahill actually appears in Kirby Miller's great Emigrants and Exiles text. It makes a very fleeting appearance in the text, but he's mentioned as somebody who kind of speaks ill of his life in America and the hard work that they had to do in the very harsh weather of working in the forests in the summers and everything else. So I was very kind of, I suppose, apt to look to those factors that Kirby had mentioned initially and see if I could slot Owen in. But from working with his family and looking at family records that they provided me and letters and even, I suppose, some kind of family folklore, it appeared that his emigration during that time was actually much more kind of personal circumstance. He was actually in an arranged marriage with a woman who was about 10 years his senior. And they had two young children. And it's great. I was actually in an event in Limerick City recently, and I met with some members of the O'Cahill family who still live in West Limerick and came in for the event. And there was some other kind of local Shanachie, Tyke, who came as well. And he had done some work on Owen O'Cahill and other kind of local historical figures of interest. And the story was that Owen O'Cahill was kind of working the butter. He used to bring the butter cart down to the market. And, you know, they said he brought it down one day and never came back. It was the local story at the moment. But what we do know is that he did go over to the U.S. He did leave the two children and his wife, who I think the local priest was actually involved in this kind of arranging of the marriage, and his father certainly was, and it was based on property. I mean, it's kind of a fascinating case in so much as when he goes to the U.S., he actually remarries a number of times. He was married four times in the U.S. So there's quite a few descendants in the U.S. as well, and they were quite helpful with, you know, providing information for this work. But, you know, unlike a lot of other Irish immigrants, his story is very personal to his circumstances back in West Limerick.
Am I correct? Did I read he was like 23 only when he went to the States? So he was young, right, Pat?
He was only 23 when he went out to the U.S., and I think he was 18 when he was married.
Oh, wow. Wow. And you know, for context for people listening, you know, that kind of a marriage, you know, would have been the norm of the time, right, in terms of, you know, how inheritance worked and, you know, the zeal of within Irish society to, you know, kind of marry at the same class level, approximately, for want of a better way of saying it, socioeconomically, right? So him marrying this kind of arranged system that seems kind of weird to us in the 21st century in Ireland was very much par for the course of the time, right?
Absolutely.
So can you tell me a little bit, Pat, about its Temple Eglantine? Is that how you pronounce it? Every time I look...
Yeah, Temple Glenton or Temple on Glenton.
Okay, right. So that, yeah, in Irish, it makes more sense. Like a lot of those.
More sense than the original. Yeah. Like all the place names in Ireland, I suppose.
Yeah. Let me ask you to parse out a little bit, Pat, if you don't mind, because I know this is like, you know, a real area of interest to you and a real area of your expertise. He's not in an area where Irish was the native tongue as such at the time, although, you know, obviously Irish would have been not a foreign language as such. But can you contextualise a little bit his linguistic background vis-a-vis Limerick and then, you know, the States, and how you kind of draw out and maybe others have, what the impact of moving abroad had on his sense of identity vis-a-vis the language?
It's interesting because from Ón Ó Cathail's own words, he would have kind of said, and of course he's writing in Irish here, but he would have said the older people in the community spoke fluent Irish and that the younger people in the community would have had broken English. I suppose, you know, it would have fitted into what we'd call kind of a brach Gaeltacht, or, you know, kind of a you know, broken Gaeltacht or speckled Gaeltacht area. And one of the things that I include actually in the introduction is the 1851 census, which shows that I suppose 60% of the adult population in the area of West Limerick, where Temple Glenton is located, still spoke Irish in 1851. And the contextualized, you know, in terms of Ireland at the time, that would actually be much higher than kind of the provincial figure of 43.9% in Munster and the national figure of 29.1%. So Irish was still quite strong there. I suppose Owen, I mean, in his linguistic background, and I tried to kind of stress that as much as I could in the work, in the introduction and with footnotes. And I mean, it's evident in his own writings as well. He talks quite a bit about his linguistic background, that strangely, he says that he actually would have kind of written and read Irish better than he spoke Irish when he went to the U.S. in 1863. Now, speaking with that same individual who came into the event recently in Limerick, he said that he would kind of question that a bit because Irish still would have been very much a communal language in Temple Glenton at the time. And Owen does kind of, you know, give somewhat a description of this kind of, you know, the storytelling tradition, you know, where you have these Shanachies in the local area who have their repertoire of tales in the Irish language and who would come to different houses on different nights and kind of, you know, give a tale of from their repertoire. So he certainly understood Irish, but, you know, he says that when he came onto the docks in New York, he saw every other race in the world, and that's his word, he says, Kenya, Sidoan, every race in the world, speaking their own language except for the Irish and the Scandinavians. And interestingly enough, and he says that at that point, he became very ashamed that he couldn't speak Irish to the degree that he wanted to. And then he, in a letter to Douglas Hyde, actually kind of lists all of the different immigrants, fellow immigrants, that helped him kind of hone his Irish language skills in terms of spoken Irish. So he mentions a professor of classics at University of Ann Arbor, who he actually would have lived with for a bit. And he said that, you know, he helped him kind of put together the grammar of the language. He had a native speaking foreman of a railroad in Michigan, from West Kerry, who he said he never would have spoken a word of English with. And then of course, I suppose we think he was a cop in Chicago in 73 to 76. Those interested in the history of Irish America, who else was a police officer known for going around and collecting precious cultural elements at that time in the Chicago police force, but Chief O'Neill? So I think that Ón Ó Cathail does mention that when he was in Chicago, he was actually collecting manuscripts, Irish language manuscripts, and he mentions that he was able to transcribe a copy of Oisin and Niamh and Tir na n-Óg from an immigrant from Mayo who had a copy. So I think maybe beyond just linguistic skills and the ability to communicate in Irish, it was when he went to the U.S. that he understood the importance of Irish. When he wasn't in maybe the British colonial system, you know, he kind of saw it as a marker of identity, which he maybe wouldn't have appreciated, even though, you know, there was Irish spoken in Temple Gletton. He didn't understand its importance until he was in the U.S.
And I suppose that kind of, what would you say, not cliche, but that kind of narrative that we'd see in terms of like taking it for granted because it's there kind of in your orbit. And then when you're, you know, when he steps outside of that by emigrating and then is placing the language on a, you know, similar footing to other European and non-European languages which are being spoken by immigrants at the time, it gives him that perspective. It's really, he's a really interesting example of that kind of journey, I suppose, that you've probably come across, Pat, in other diasporic characters and ones who, I suppose, in a way, Pat, it's almost more, well, I guess you can't really maybe put a value judgment on it, but to think about the non-native, like he is familiar with the language, but that kind of, it's not even like he's a native speaker where it's kind of at his fingertips that he's pushing himself to increase his fluency and think about it in that new way. Do you know what I mean? In comparison to, you know, simply a native speaker for whom it's kind of at their fingertips or their tongue tips, so to say. Do you know what I'm saying?
That actually touches on a really like brilliant point in terms of, I mean, the other Irish language text that we see, and I think it's much more well known, obviously, definitely at this stage, of an Irish-speaking immigrant in the American West is obviously Mickey McGowan from Donegal, and, you know, a native speaker from the Donegal Gaeltacht in Gaeilge. And he, you know, he's writing in the text. His text is quite different in that he was not writing it traditionally as Owen O'Cahill was writing these stories by hand, but he gave the story orally to his son-in-law, Sean O'Hoy, the great folklorist. But it's interesting that he actually talks about, to go back to the example that I mentioned of Owen O'Cahill, you know, writing about the Little Bighorn, that Mickey McGowan actually writes about the Little Bighorn as well. And when he's writing about it, you know, he says, oh, I heard hundreds of stories about the Little Bighorn and the fights between the cavalry and the Native Americans out in the West. And he uses the term in English, Little Bighorn, when he's talking about it, whereas Owen O'Cahill Gaelicizes it. And I think that we see that with, you know, a lot of time new speakers of Irish, particularly, I think, in places like, if you want to use the term new speakers of Irish, but, you know, places like Belfast and places where the language is very much a marker of identity, that there's more of a tendency to Gaelicize things rather than sometimes in Gaeltacht regions, you know, you would just, if it's a non-Irish term, you would just use the English. But we see even, you know, going back, you know, Owen O'Cahill has that tendency himself rather than, you know, Mickey McGowan writing in the, I suppose, dictating his stories in the 20th century.
That's something I learned myself, Pat, when I, you know, years ago when I was in, I suppose, actually my last major stint in the Gaeltacht in Connemara, and just seeing how, you know, my far auntie and ban auntie in the house I was staying, but more so the far auntie, I used to kind of stay up talking to him late at night, and he's the most beautiful Irish. But I was always struck by, you know, I'd be going to say a term or whatever, and, you know, I wouldn't have the linguistic skill at the time, or even now, actually less so, but I'd be saying, oh, how do I say this in Irish even? You know what I mean? That kind of instinct of translating, whereas he'd only ever say that word in English. It was an English word, and it was rendered in its original, you know, that kind of way. It's fascinating, actually, how that works. I thought I was the only person who noticed that, so obviously it's more of a thing.
I ran into it myself. Actually, I was on the Aran Islands, and I'm from Hartford in Connecticut, and there's a lot of Aran Islanders, big chain migration to Hartford, so we have a lot of Islanders here. My wife Shiva and I were back on Inishmeon, and just by chance there were a load of people who were friends with my parents, and I would have grown up knowing them and whatnot. They were back for the summer on the island, and I was talking in Irish with them, and they didn't really appreciate my Ulster Irish, Belfast Irish, but we were talking, they were asking where we lived in Galway City, and I said, oh yeah, in Achilles and Ard Agus, near the cathedral. And she let out a laugh, and she said, the Ard Agus, faker for Agus the focal fancy. And she said, we call it the cathedral. So I said, all right, I won't be doing that again, you know? So I got the point very quick, but I think that's, you know, very much you see it with Ona Cahill as well, that he has that tendency to just, okay, if he can Gaelicize it, Gaelicize it.
Oh, that's a great, I love hearing that, Pat. If you don't mind, now I know I'm lingering a lot before we kind of get to the meat and bones of what actually is the central part of what you've done in this great book, is rendering his prose in the English language and collecting it together for us in an accessible way in terms of the originals, Oscailge as well. But I know you have this in the introduction, but I'm a little bit fascinated, Pat, if I can ask you to share with me a little bit about Eoin O'Cahill's educational background, you know, that which with which he leaves from Ireland with, you know, because the jobs that he's not a man of letters as such. Can you tell us what you've reconstructed? And I'm saying that with admiration and commending him, and actually food for thought for us in terms of actually how we, any of us, engage with the language or the history in that sense. Tell us a little bit about what kind of an education he would have had in the first instance.
I suppose he's a fascinating character in this sense as well, because in terms of the Irish language, he would say that his ability to read and write Irish actually came from a local, in terms of the language, in debates about the language these days, it's a particularly salient point, but he said it would actually come from a local Protestant man in Temple on Glanton called Ned Anglum. And he said that Anglum had a great collection of Irish language books, and that he taught him to read and write. And Anglum was said, anyway, in the folklore collection, that he was the local head schoolmaster. Eoin O'Cahill's grandson would have said in the folklore collection that, you know, in the days of his grandfather, that he attended a head school, and that he would have, you know, sat on bales, and they had a flag on the wall as kind of the chalkboard, and, you know, your kind of traditional image of what you'd think the head school is like. So, you know, I've included that in the text because obviously that came straight from obviously where the grandson was hearing, and he was still located in Limerick. But the national school in Temple on Glanton actually opened when Eoin O'Cahill would have been, I'm not sure the exact year here, but when he would have been probably 8 or 10, that opened. But some locals were saying recently to me that, you know, even when that opened, some families would have been apprehensive to send their children to the national school. But it's likely that he did have a national school education as well. But in terms of his, you know, in terms of the Irish language, his education did come from that kind of informal arrangement with Anglum. And there's a great story that his daughter actually gives, and she wrote kind of a family history. And she says that himself and his two sisters were learning Irish, to read and write Irish, from this local man. And that when the father found out about it, he said that they immediately were going to stop on, you know, kind of sectarian grounds. They were not to continue their Irish lessons. And she recalls that while his two sisters were kind of happy enough to cease the Irish lessons, Eoin O'Cahill just said, look, I'm continuing on. So the father grabbed him by the ear and dragged him down to the local church, as the story goes, and made him go to confession. And he said from that day on, he lost his religion because of how bigoted they were. So not, I think, your typical story. And obviously it does come more from kind of family lore than traditional sources. But that seems to kind of gel as well with the other accounts of where he himself says that he learned his written Irish.
No, but Pat, I think it's, you know, to your point, though, it's really... so much has happened in terms of, you know, kind of the sectarian, for want of a better term, like orbit of the language. And I think it's really great to have this rich example of how ownership of the language was a broad church, for want of a better, like, sorry to use, pardon the pun, but in that usage and it's really actually inspiring to hear that kind of narrative in that sense, right?
Especially that's the case amongst kind of antiquarians of the 19th century who were collecting these Irish language manuscripts and texts. And so it's just another example of, you know, kind of a more parochial example, maybe. And again, don't mind the pun, but yeah, I suppose an example of this kind of trend that we see more broadly.
The book, the meat and bones of this book is collecting Ono Cathal's prose works together in the original Irish language, and then a translation in English for people who want to engage in this really interesting, these are really interesting characterizations of 19th century America. In some of the examples that are in your collection here, there is imagery and depictions of Native Americans, which are, I suppose, of the time. And this is something in the lovely foreword to the book by the renowned American historian Richard White, who has written himself on Native American history. He underscores, or and quite rightly draws our attention to, in terms of the outlook that Owen O'Cahill had at that time, and met for many Irish immigrants and in the United States, and many Americans, right? Many immigrants from all other parts of the world. And I'm just wondering how methodologically, Pat, you dealt with that kind of language or stereotyping and depictions, and how much you thought of how colonialism, in terms of the Irish example and the experience that Owen O'Cahill would have had in Ireland, how impulses of that or characterizations of that are come through in his depictions of Native Americans in the examples of the prose.
As you mentioned, I mean, it can be very complex, you know, looking at these issues, and, you know, you have to really contextualize a character like Owen O'Cahill. And, you know, in my wider kind of research, I would actually look at, you know, members of the Fenian Brotherhood writing from these military outposts in, you know, in the West. So from Utah to Montana Territory to Colorado to California, and looking at what they're saying about the Native population, even as they're involved in, you know, an anti-imperial struggle themselves, and as members of, you know, an army who is very much kind of replicating what's happening back in their homeland in many ways. So Owen O'Cahill, I was interested in this aspect of his work, you know, based on that kind of wider research interest, but I suppose he's a different case in some ways, because I think you need to kind of place him within the genre with which he's writing and the kind of intent with which he's writing these stories. So in the book, you know, some of the pieces that are included are letters, either public letters that he's writing to newspapers back in Ireland, or private letters that he's including to the likes of Douglas Hyde, the great Gaelic revivalist and first president of Ireland, or even to his family members. So he has a private persona there, and then these stories that make up the bulk of the work are his kind of his public persona, because he did intend to have these stories published back in Ireland to an Irish language audience. And really significantly, you know, one of the things that I did while translating this was read a lot of other dime novels from that time in English language dime novels, including some that, you know, I would have evidence that Owen O'Cahill himself read. And then looking at what he's saying in his work and what messages he's kind of projecting in his work compared with what his English language peers are writing in the United States for their respective audiences. And we see that he's very much a man of his time, as you say, in terms of his depictions of Native peoples. And I think Richard White actually does mention this in his foreword to the book, that the stories can be really divided up in terms of his depictions of Native peoples. And in the earlier stories, he does depict the Plains Indian Wars, and, you know, he affords himself an active role in the Plains Indian Wars, even though we know that wasn't necessarily the case. When he depicts these fierce battles between the cavalry and Native, kind of unidentified Native tribes out on the plains. But then in his stories that are set in the upper Midwest, in Michigan and in Minnesota, Native peoples are depicted quite differently. and they usually feature as kind of loyal friends and hunting partners. And as Richard White notes, you know, those depictions are less problematic, but they still are problematic in so much as they're kind of fit the role of stock characters. There's no real distinguishable qualities about them, except for maybe one example where he depicts the wife of one of his kind of fellow woodsmen, who is a Native American woman. He does describe her, you know, quite in depth, but that's the only character that really sticks out in that regard. So I think to view O'Cahill is to view him as a man of his time and to try and understand what kind of literary veins he was tapping into for his projected audiences.
So that's really interesting. You're kind of, you read around then other authors of the period. And I suppose the dime novel was, pardon my ignorance on this, Pat, it was presumably a publication that just cost a dime and they were kind of popular literature of the era. Is that right?
Yeah, so the dime novel, you know, kind of arises in the kind of mid-1860s, around the same time that O'Cahill actually would have landed into the U.S. It emerges as, you know, a very popular literary form. And it's predominantly kind of a working class literature. It's, it gets its name, obviously, because it was very cheap. And in the U.K. and in Ireland as well, I think it was referred to as kind of penny dreadfuls. And, you know, it was very accessible because it was kind of formulaic plots, quite kind of, you know, simple plots and simple language. And it actually catered as well to, you know, kind of those who were literate, but also illiterate, because they were often read aloud. And it kind of taps into then a wider form of American pop culture when you have figures like Buffalo Bill Cody, who, you know, becomes one of these early dime novel stars and then takes his kind of swagger and his image to the stage. And, you know, then you have these kind of Western stage shows with these dime novel characters who are these, you know, real figures that people can see and touch. And, you know, it kind of brings that popular culture of the American West to the fore, predominantly in kind of industrial cities of the East and even in the, I suppose, into the Midwest as well, places like Chicago.
So would you say, like, Pat, did you get a sense in your research about Owen O'Cahill and his writings in this vein? Do you think that he, like, was this motivated much or at all by a kind of a business opportunity in terms of writing these stories, rendering them in Irish and kind of, you know, spotting that kind of niche in the market in terms of Irish language literature? But presumably, I mean, how much were these read or sold? Did you have any sense of that?
I do. I came across that in a number of instances. I mean, the way that I found the stories initially or came across the manuscripts was that he sent them back to Douglas Hyde with the hope of getting them published. And, you know, you had Ongoom, the kind of government agency for furthering print in the Irish language, is founded in 1926. And he hoped that Douglas Hyde could kind of use a connection and get these stories put into print. And he kind of confided in a letter to his niece, who was actually a famous actress, Florence Johns, would have been kind of a stage actress and did some early film as well. But he wrote a private letter to her and he tells her about these manuscripts and he says, look, if I can get a fair price for these, I'll be on the pig's back. You know, if I can get a royalty, good royalty price, I'll be on the pig's back. He, you know, very much says he wants to have these, you know, readily available to Irish speakers back in Ireland. But Douglas Hyde wrote a private letter after O'Cahill's death to his daughter because she says, look, it was always his dream to have these stories put in print. And, you know, that obviously didn't happen. And we'd like to have it done now after he's gone, you know, as kind of a legacy. And Douglas Hyde writes her and says, look, you know, I tried to have your dad's stories printed while he was alive. And the Irish was too idiomatic. It was too kind of provincial, like, you know, and it was, he was writing in, you know, this pre-standardized Irish of the mid-19th century. And Douglas Hyde just said, look, that's not where the Irish language print culture is going in Ireland these days. So I tried everything that I could and I failed. So the only place that they, I mean, the only people that presumably would have really read these stories at the time were obviously O'Cahill himself, a few close friends in the U.S., and he mailed it back to Douglas Hyde. And then the only contemporary review that we have of any of his work is actually of his poetry. And it was in the Chicago Times. And they call him an unknown Irish poet from Michigan. And they note that he was in Michigan. And they say that when the time and circumstance of his writings is considered, they have to be considered exceptional, because he was writing, you know, totally isolated in the linguistic sense up in Michigan. So that's the only, the stories never reached the audience that he kind of envisioned.
Let me ask you this, Pat. So I think you wouldn't mind reading from one for me. Is that right? I think it would be great to give the listeners a sense of an extract of one. Would you be able to do that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'll just give a brief little background, I suppose.
Yeah,
on
the, yeah, yeah.
So it doesn't come out of nowhere for the reader, for the listeners out there. So this is a story called Trip to Texas. It's when Owen O'Cahill is a member of a government mule train riding with the cavalry. And they're going through kind of rural Texas, and they've set up camp, and they've had a number of adventures at this point. He's come across another emigrant from Limerick, and there's a lot of adventures in there. But at this stage, they're approached by, a runaway slave. And this would have been around 1868 or 1869. So as we know, long after abolition and the war's end as well. And so this is the conversation that Owen O'Cahill has with this young enslaved black man. So he says, "Why didn't you leave your master years ago?" I asked. "Didn't you know that all the slaves were freed according to the laws of this country going on 6 years now? It was illegal for your master to deny anyone their freedom." And he replies, "We had no idea of that until last month. A white man came along one day around then and told us that we were free now and that we could independently walk away from our master. That man was hanged the same evening for, quote, lying to the slaves. A week later, my brother left after nightfall. The next morning, they sent the dogs after him. They caught him hiding up a tree, and they took him home. They hanged him in front of us all. That sight sent a shudder of fear through us all, and we were all obedient again from then on. How did you leave the estate without the overseer noticing? My master had gone to the city, and I'd seen that our overseer was drunk, but there were 10 bloodthirsty, ravenous dogs by his side. They were all outside the doors of the cabins. There were no back doors on these cabins, but they had little windows. I went out through a little window and went straight to the horse pasture. I had a bridle and a long, slender rope. I took a grip of the horse and immediately got up on its back and on the road towards the land of freedom. I knew freedom awaited me in this place. After listening to this tale, I said, 'You were correct, you poor crather. You're certainly free now. You are your own master from here on out.'" And I'll leave it there.
Wow, powerful. And how was the process of translating that and the other tales, Pat?
I suppose I found it, I think powerful is the perfect word, just because I think it's very rare that we see topics like this addressed in the Irish language at that time. So however O'Cahill might be problematic in other ways, he is addressing topics that, we don't see even Irish language or Irish writers in English in the U.S. at the time probably addressing, to that degree. So, yeah, I will say just in a linguistic sense that paragraph is probably good, because there was one word there that listeners might have noticed that I didn't translate, and Miriam, you'll appreciate this, is crather. When he says, "You poor crather, you're your own master now." I kind of mulled over that, and I actually talked to a few different friends and said, do you put "you poor thing" in there, or do you just leave it as "you poor crather," which is probably what Owen O'Cahill himself would have said at the time talking in English. And I think it's one of those kind of untranslatable terms in some sense, because I think "poor thing" probably comes off a bit patronizing,
mm-hmm.
which is not the intent of the context of that conversation. So, there were a number of instances like that where you really had to, I suppose, read the text quite closely and, even write out a few different options of, okay, what's the best way to say this? And not only that, but, and as I mentioned earlier, in terms of me reading a lot of other dime novel literature in English of the time, but making sure that these stories read like stories of the time rather than modern, the way that I would maybe phrase things, looking back and saying, okay, how would Ono Kaho actually say this in English himself? And how would his peers say this at the time in terms of, you know, specific terms from the period?
Yeah, that must have been fun, but probably time consuming, Pat, to be thinking of those to make them historically accurate. You're right. I mean, creature is a great example of, you know, that, you know, what other word would you use that would kind of give the correct impression? And I'd imagine that you had quite a few instances of terms or turns of phrase in that vein, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Pat, can I ask you? I'm conscious of time now, and you've been more than generous. But it's really fascinating conversation, and he's a fascinating character, and how grateful we should all be in terms of you, as I said at the start, kind of recovering his voice for us in this way, and for people to be able to engage with the originals in Oscailge, and to, you know, for those of us who need the help along with the translation as well, it's wonderful. But how, and you mentioned that he crops up in Kirby's tome, or, you know, how did you, like, how did this, what are the origins of this project?
Yes, the origins, I suppose, I had seen his name in, as I mentioned, Kirby's great text, and actually Kenneth Nielsen as well, the late Kenneth Nielsen, mentions his poetry more than anything else, in one instance. And my kind of interest was actually piqued after seeing the reference from Ken Nielsen, because he just mentioned, oh, there was this Irish poet out on the plains writing about Native Americans, is how he put it. And then I found out, you know, actually going into the archives, that in NUI Galway and in the National Library of Ireland, that there were these prose works as well. So I read the poetry, I read the prose, and I suppose I looked at, or I suppose the quote that kind of came to me was, there's a librarian and kind of archivist, J. Randolph Cox, said that, like, in terms of the dime novel, it's not necessarily about the literary quality, but looking at him through a lens of social history from the United States between roughly like kind of 1860 to 1915, that allows so many insights into, you know, the mindset and the popular culture of the U.S. during that time. So I looked at these prose, that, you know, kind of quote immediately came to mind, and I thought, okay, these stories really should be, you know, made available for scholars of the American West, and, you know, U.S. history, scholars of U.S. history, you know, to engage with multilingual sources, and particularly in the Irish context. I think, you know, histories of the Irish abroad are often history of Irish language immigrants, or, you know, to different countries. They don't really consider the Irish language a lot of times. So that was my kind of driving motivation behind putting the work together. And then I was actually awarded a Fulbright scholarship to NUI Galway to put this work together and to kind of put them out in a volume. And then obviously COVID hit, so, you know, it was a wild year, but being locked in quarantine for 7 to 8 months initially, you know, really helped kind of the motivation of, okay, let's, you know, sit down and get this thing done.
Can I just ask you, Pat, again, I'm sorry I'm taking up a lot of your time, but you mentioned that you're a Hartford native, and it's clear you're a sense of fluency and passion and knowledge of the beautiful Irish language. Would you mind, for the benefit of our listeners, and, you know, it's, you know, I hope it's not in any way patronizing, but, like, you know, the fluency and the skill that you have with the language, which, you know, presumably you didn't grow up with, maybe, or maybe you did grow up with it at home or in school, you know, you're not in, you didn't grow up in an Irish in Ireland setting. Would you mind telling us a little bit about your language, your journey into the Irish language and your appreciation for it?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's not a problem at all. Yeah, I suppose I would have actually heard, as I mentioned earlier, the Irish language spoken quite regularly in Hartford, in the Irish Club, and Hartford, the Irish American Home Society in Hartford. There's a lot of West Kerry people and Aran Islands people. Even in my dad's family, there would have been Irish spoken kind of in the background, you know, but it was never passed on. like so many other families in the U.S. and in Ireland as well. But I actually learned my Irish, you know, in my Irish to fluency when I was around college age. I got a job with, and, you know, since I kind of, you know, we call him my adopted godfather, but a guy, Geraldo McDade, is from the New Lodge Road in Belfast, and he was actually in the H-Box for 8 years. And he took me under his wing and gave me a job actually working construction. Most mornings I would arrive to the site maybe an hour early, and he would do an Irish lesson with me.
Wow.
And he'd give me words and phrases and slangs and, you know, anything you could really want in terms of that. And I suppose it was interesting because we, you know, initially I didn't actually write anything down. So we used to just do the lessons on my phone. And I had kind of an old flip phone at that stage, and I would do the recordings on there, and I would just listen back to him every night. And he would just say, look, Padraig, you know, just listen to the things, repeat them like I do, and then you'll use them the next day with me when we're working. And then if you get something wrong, I'll correct you. And then, you know, just keep, you'll be able to put it together then yourself after a while. So that's what I did. And, you know, more and more and more, you know, we'd have these little debates in Irish, and, you know, we'd be talking about different topics through Irish, and he'd be telling me stories. I think in terms of my appreciation for the language around that time, he didn't just teach me the Irish language, but he also gave me a copy of Black Skin, White Masks by Franz Fanon, which is, I mean, just blew my mind reading that text in terms of post-colonial identity and, you know, the relation of language to identity and, I suppose, building that appreciation. He gave me The Wretched of the Earth as well by Fanon, and also a book of the collected writings of Stephen Biko, the South African anti-apartheid activist. Mm. So I suppose for me, the language became connected with this kind of wider, I suppose, kind of vision of identity and decoloniality. And with Geraldo's own story as well, and learning it in the blocks, he had no writing materials. They used to just etch it into the walls and, you know, shout down the wings. And then after a while, he taught me to read and write as well, first with children's books and then with kind of more probably advanced texts. And then I did a degree. Then I went on to NUI Galway, and I did a diploma as the Gaelic. And that was kind of an adventure at first, because I'd only really talked to Geraldo. So when I heard, you know, all these Connemara people and my teacher was from Connemara, my head was just spinning, like, because I was thinking, what is this? Like, this isn't Irish, or not as I had learned it anyway. And so I had to really adapt to the different dialects. But that really kind of honed my skills then as well.
Well, and has made you all the better scholar, I no doubt. Listen, Pat, thank you for your time. This is a great intervention in the field and a great read. It's called Recovering an Irish Voice from the American Frontier. It's by Patrick J. Mahoney, Padraig Mahuna, with a foreword by Richard White, published by University of North Texas Press, a 2021 publication. But I'm really delighted to have the opportunity to share the details of it and have this wonderful conversation with you here on This Irish American Life. Pat, thanks for coming on today. You've been really generous with your time.
Thanks so much, Miriam.
This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records.